The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. Going with the grain. It took thousands of years, but America's founding farmers developed the grain that would fuel civilizations, and still does. By Charles C. Mann. Sometimes it's the little things that count. Movie archaeologists are often pictured triumphantly extracting precious objects from the earth, instantly solving long-standing mysteries. Think of Indiana Jones, Cross of Coronado, Staff of Ra, and Ark of the Covenant. Real archaeologists mostly find small, almost valueless objects, and won't know for years or decades what mystery they are resolving. Consider this ancient ear of maize, pictured on the other page, which Walter Howe pulled out of a New Mexico cave more than a century ago. Howe worked at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, the repository of this artifact, from 1886 to 1935. A kindly man with a static cling memory who hunted arrowheads as a boy in West Virginia. He spent most of his career on the unsung but vital task of cataloging the museum's collections. But he also took field trips into the Southwest. And in September 1905, he spent 12 days in what he called an interesting cave. It was in a bluff, 150 feet above the Tularosa River in New Mexico, about 30 miles east of the Arizona border. Because the climate there is extremely dry, virtually nothing in the cave had decayed. Formerly used by early colonists as a donkey corral, the cave was full of rubbish and the droppings of animals to a depth of 8 feet, Howe wrote. Just walking around kicked up a choking cloud of dust that forced researchers to wear goggles and cover their faces. Despite the terrible conditions, the researchers made an impressive haul: dried turkey cadavers, mammal bones, broken crockery, a brush made from glass, incense pipes, stones for grinding, cigarettes made from reeds, yucca leaf sandals, and about a dozen maize cobs, some with kernels intact. Archaeologists typically call the grain maize rather than corn, because multicolored indigenous maize, usually eaten after drying and grinding, is strikingly unlike the large sweet yellow kernel cobs conjured up by the word corn. Howe was working before archaeologists had the tools to accurately date artifacts, or even pre-GPS, to note their exact location. He simply recorded the locale of his finds and carried them back to Washington, D.C. It would be 4.5 decades before Paul Sidney Martin, an archaeologist at Chicago's Field Museum, examined Howe's reports and followed in his footsteps. Most archaeologists specializing in the Southwest believe that its earliest inhabitants were the Anasazi, as the ancestral Pueblo were then known, who built cliff dwellings in Mesa Verde, 225 miles north of Tularosa Cave. But a few experts argued that the Tularosa area had housed a different culture, called the Mogollon, M-O-G-O-L-L-O-N, after a nearby mountain range. To resolve what was becoming a bitter controversy, Martin and his co-workers went to Tularosa Cave in June 1950, the first researchers there since Howe. In 2 summers, they unearthed tens of thousands of artifacts, and they made a convincing case that the pottery they found, especially starkly beautiful black and white remnants, looked nothing like Anasazi handiwork. Among the Tularosa objects were, astonishingly, 33,000 ears of ancient maize. Fortuitously, Martin had access to a brand new technology, radiocarbon dating, just invented at the University of Chicago. It can determine the age of plant remains and other organic materials. Indeed, the Tularosa cobs were among the first archaeological finds ever carbon dated. Martin reported that some of the cobs were as old as 2,500 years. That suggested the cave had been inhabited before the Anasazi. Key evidence, along with the unusual cave artifacts for a separate Mogollon culture. From about AD 200 to the arrival of the Spaniards, the Mogollon had occupied most of what is now Sonora and Chihuahua in Mexico, as well as parts of southern Arizona and New Mexico. Their ancestors began as foragers, then switched to agriculture, including the cultivation of maize, which helped fuel the flowering of Mogollon culture. The Mogollon, in turn, played a large role in introducing maize to societies north of the Rio Grande, a pivotal event as important to North America as the arrival of rice was to China, or wheat to the Middle East. Howe and Martin didn't have the scientific tools to analyze the genetic makeup of their maize specimens and trace precise origins or lineage. Perhaps hoping that future researchers would pore over his finds as he had pored over Howe's, Martin and his co-workers sealed thousands of ancient cobs in plastic bags that are stored today at the Field Museum, the world's greatest collection of Mogollon artifacts and remains. Lately, researchers using DNA probes and other technologies have been detailing the roughly 9,000-year process by which Native Americans transform teosinte, the smallish semi-tropical grass with no ears or cobs, into maize, a productive, elaborate plant that can thrive in a cool, temperate climate. In 2003, analysis of cobs from Tularosa and locations in Mexico, researchers found that the earliest samples, some 6,300 years old, were apparently bred by people focused on boosting the crop yield by increasing the size of cobs and kernels. Later in Mogollon times, growers were selecting for starch and grain qualities useful in making tortillas and tamales. The transformation of a weedy grass into one of the world's most important foodstuffs, think of the enormous stalks of corn rippling across Midwestern fields, is far more complex than anything we can do today in a lab, even with all our genetic prowess. How the continent's first farmers accomplished that feat is a mystery. Drab debris found in a cave may hold the clues. By Charles C. Mann. American Rhapsody. 70 classical musicians, 200 acres of wind-blown prairie, and the bracing spirit of the heartland. A Kansas Symphony in 6 Movements. By Jeff McGregor. Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Dr. Brewster Higley, 1873. This might be the most beautiful place in America. Walk with me. Walk a while up and down these Kansas hills, where the tall grass prairie rolls out deep green on every side, the land rising and falling to a faraway horizon, out to the silent edge of a high, hot sky, the big blue stem and the wild alfalfa and the switchgrass and the Indian grass and the buffalo grass waving and swaying in the wind, gathering in steam beds where the eastern red cedar and the cottonwood shadow the springs and seeps until even your own footsteps sound far away, and that abiding green reaches for you, and finally, gratefully, you feel yourself dissolving into the immensity of the world. You are taken up, even as you slip away. This landscape is its own poetry, a match for the breadth and reach of your imagination, a wilderness of perfect solitude. There are no politics here, only peace, no sadness, only hope, no doubt, only certainty. Not a house, not a fence, not a single human sign, only you, alone, at last, at one with everything, until you crest the final gentle rise, and there in front of you are 6,000 people and the Kansas City Symphony Orchestra. And as the familiar moderato of Smetana's Moldau in E minor from Mavast is carried away on a stiff wind, along with the mooing of a half-hundred cattle, you'll be forgiven for thinking you've lost your mind. Seriously, it's like that scene in Fitzcarraldo, where they haul the steamship over the mountain. An opera house in the Amazon jungle? Sure. A symphony on the prairie in the middle of nowhere? Whatever. This is June in Kansas, and this is Symphony in the Flint Hills. Start here. The map on Annie Wilson's dining room table. Annie Wilson is a rancher, and an educator, and a lawyer, and a songwriter, and a singer. Mostly, these days, people seem to know her for her singing. She has a fine voice, sweet but resolute. You can often catch her on Friday nights at the Cottonwood Falls Artist Co-op open mic. She is also the official, state-appointed, governor-approved Flint Hills balladeer. She is slender and sharp-featured, and wears glasses and has blonde hair she sometimes keeps in a pair of unbraided pigtails, or lets down when she sings. She is at the age when folks stop asking your age. In the pictures from the album cover, she wears a red sash at her waist and a big straw cowboy hat. She writes songs with titles like Sail the Summer Sky and My Diamond Creek Cowboy and Big Blue Stem, King of the Prairie. She and her husband John live on a ranch a few miles west of Elmdale, Kansas, which is itself a few miles west of Cottonwood Falls, Kansas, which is itself pretty far from anywhere, but is the home of the loveliest little government building in the country, the Chase County Courthouse. We're 2 miles southwest of Kansas City, Missouri, by car, or more likely by charcoal gray metallic F-350 crew cab, power stroke, dually, with a fifth wheel hitch, 2 bales of hay and a Rubbermaid filled with horseshoeing tools in the bed. This is the center of the Flint Hills. Annie has been pointing this out on the map, which she helped develop and distributes along with lesson plans to regional schools and museums. The map shows what amounts to the last of the tall grass prairie in America. There used to be 170 million acres of it, from Canada down to Texas. We plowed most of it under, almost all of it. Outside a few preserves and set-asides, much of what little is left now occupies a 60-mile wedge of bright green, running from about Blue Rapids, Kansas, down to Fairfax, Oklahoma. Annie's map details the last few acres of one of Earth's greatest and fastest disappearing temperate grasslands. For the past 40 years, she and her neighbors have been fighting like hell, sometimes with each other, to keep it intact. The threats to this fragile landscape are many, and immediate, and far too familiar. Real estate and commercial development, pollution, extraction, invasive plants, climate change, power generation, wind farms, oil fields, fracking, pipelines, dams, highways. Sitting at her dining room table, we go through the ecology and the science and the history of this place, the economy and the geology and the politics, some of which finds its way into the grade appropriate lesson plans Annie writes for the school districts. Around 275 million years ago, Kansas was the eastern floor of a warm, shallow body of water, covering much of what is now the American Midwest. For hundreds of centuries, as minerals and tiny Dead Sea critters settled to the bottom along with their contribution of calcium carbonate, limestone was forming on the ocean bed. In the cracks and crevices of that limestone were the mudstones and cherts, call them shale and flint, that now make up the soft rock, hard rock layer cake of these hills. Bake for a few million years, leave that cake out in the rain long enough, and it eventually erodes into the rounded swells and tabletops and washes we walk today. For thousands of years, the first people of North America walked it, came and went across these sun-shot hills and hollows, hunting bison and elk. Europeans eventually hiked, blinking out the claustrophobic eastern forests, and by the beginning of the 19th century, exploration here was underway in earnest. In 1806, Zebulon Pike, footsore and no great speller, gave the place its name when noting in his journal, "Commenced our march at 7 o'clock, past very rough flint hills, my feet blistered and very sore." Down in Oklahoma, these are called the Osage Hills and make up a substantial part of the land overseen by and under the care of the Osage Nation. Then and now, from microbes to migratory birds, the tallgrass prairie is one of the richest, most diverse ecosystems on the continent. By the middle 1800s, there were homesteaders and farmers coming and going, tearing up the prairies with their newfangled steel plows. And once that native grass is plowed, it never comes back as it was. Never. Nor does the habitat it provides for innumerable species of animal life. What saved these hills was the flint. And the shale and the limestone. You couldn't get a plow into it, so the pioneers left the uplands alone, but tilled most of that rich acreage down in the bottoms by the rivers and the streams. Out on the hills they ran cattle, and cattle means cowboys, and inevitably commerce and ranches and fences and towns and railroads. And the economy and the mythology of the Flint Hills were well and truly launched by about 1880. Because it turns out the tallgrass prairie is not only stunning, but luscious. Cattle fatten fast here, profitably so. And over the years, the Flint Hills became famous for its vast ranches and transient beef operations. Bring in a herd of market cattle for a few months, fatten them up, and ship them back out. Part of that has to do with above-average rainfall in eastern Kansas and the way the limestone stores or redistributes it. Part of it has to do with the nutritive value of those deep-rooted prairie grasses, pulling valuable proteins and minerals up to where the cattle can make use of them. Part has to do with the heritage of hard work every rancher shares with every other, and part has to do with fire. In early spring, ranchers here burn a regional patchwork of pasture land, flames 30 feet high, smoke so thick it closes the interstate. A week or two or three later, those blackened acres come back green and bright as an emerald. The new growth is irresistible to cattle. And for thousands of years before that, to the buffalo. Native people burned the tall grass, too, as an attractor for the elk and bison they hunted. And fire keeps the prairie from being overrun by trees. Back into prehistory, lightning did that work. So earth, air, fire, and water, 275 million years worth of it, makes it seem simple. But history is rougher even than flint. The death and displacement of Native Americans in service of manifest destiny, or free enterprise, or private property cannot be ignored, nor can the environmental costs of development and profit-taking on these last few acres of one of the country's greatest treasures. This is some of the most contested ground in America. The fight among ranchers and farmers and environmentalists and politicians and energy producers will never be completely settled. But lasting alliances and a lot of progress have been made lately. For example, it seems intuitive that ranchers were the most natural stewards of the remaining tall grass and stood to benefit most by its careful management. As conservationists learn not to villainize them, but rather to work with them and guide them to best practices. And the ranchers learn to listen and compromise. They all found themselves on the same side. Partnerships between public and private interests, scientists and politicians, the National Park Service and the Nature Conservancy, have been helping protect more and more land here by limiting development with conservation easements. The easements are voluntary and legally binding. They place permanent restrictions on how landowners can use private property by specifying which resources are to be protected. They've been an elegant answer in a polarizing debate, but the essential tension between profit and preservation is a constant. The prairie only feels infinite. It is not. Annie's quiet for a minute. The dining room table is lined with family photos. Just then, she says, "I think that our best hope through all this is education. I feel like what can bring us together, what we can do, is find common ground, and that is our love of the land. I really believe all of the sides do love the land." Brian Obermeyer, bearded and affable, is the Flint Hills Project Director at the Nature Conservancy. Kristen Haas of the National Park Service is the Chief of Natural Resources and Acting Superintendent of the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve. A ranger hat is perfect. They run the preserve together. This is where the buffalo roam. The preserve used to be the old Z-Bar Ranch. Before that, it was the Spring Hill Ranch. And it's a beauty. More than 10,000 acres of rolling tall grass, a limestone mansion with a giant limestone barn, and its own herd of American bison, about 100 head. It became a natural preserve in 1996. Haas and Obermeyer go back and forth like old college chums from Emporia State, which is what they are. "It is a unique public-private partnership between NPS and TNC," said Obermeyer. "We're the third private landowner since establishment of the preserve. Before that, it was in the National Park Trust, and they ran into some financial challenges, and so TNC stepped in and acquired the property. It's a nearly 11,000-acre property, and the Park Service owns only about 34 acres, but the entire property is a unit of the National Park Service." Nancy Kassenbaum proposed this idea of a new model for the National Park Service where the park's privately owned and the government cannot own more than 180 acres of this park. The ranches see the advantage of the preservation because that's agreeable to the ancient practice of the bison. Because that's agreeable to the ancient practice of the bison. They're going to move across the land, and they're going to eat and eat and eat. And then they're going to go away. Then things will burn in the spring, and then they'll come back in the next. That's the classic cycle, and the ranchers go along with that because that's how they do their work anyway. Altogether, I think we're at about 110,000 acres of conservation easements in the Flint Hills. The goal for the Flint Hills Legacy Conservation Area is to eventually have 1.1 million acres of conservation easements in the Flint Hills. Bob Maines is the state director for the Nature Conservancy in Kansas. His smile is a beacon, and his dress shirt is pressed to crisp perfection. And his concern for the Flint Hills are pressure from wind energy and agricultural encroachment and water pollution and commercial development and the oil business and nuisance plants and invasive species like Johnson grass and eastern red cedar and honey locust and smooth sumac and humans. If you stop the burns, the whole prairie will be lost to trees in 30 to 50 years. But if you burn too much, too often, you destroy habitat for threatened species like the lesser prairie chicken. If you graze off or plow under too much of the native grasses, maybe those fields come back choked with less palatable, less nutritious, old-world blue stems introduced by us 100 years ago for forage and to control erosion and now everywhere along the roadsides and fence lines. Big blue stem, scientific name Andropogon gerardi, is the King Kong of the Flint Hills, the anchor grass. Its roots and tillers literally hold these hills together, a web traveling deep into the rock and soil, gripping the flint and stabilizing the substructure while pumping moisture and mineral-rich nutrients up to the blades, there to be eaten by the beef or bison or the woolly mammoth. It is a thing to see, walking in an uncropped field, an ungrazed tallgrass pasture on a hillside in the wind is like swimming in a soft green sea. Late-arriving grasses with names like villains from Game of Thrones, Bathra cola bladi and Chloris verticillata, Caucasian bluestem and windmill grass, crowd out the native tall grass. Push down hard on a possible solution here, and a thornier, new problem pops up over there. Worst case, the whole prairie collapses in a couple of decades. Nature is perfect, but once touched, how do we untouch it? And yet Maine's, emphatically, is an optimist. We don't have the science perfect. We don't have to have perfect answers. We don't have to get the economics perfect. We just got to get close and get started. Most of the agricultural producers, most of the industry folks are ready to go. I know we're better people than to pass on an easy opportunity like this. The same is true with agriculture as it is with renewable energy and climate change. We can fix this stuff. The foothills don't have to disappear into a boiling climate or the dust of a plow. The foothills can be here for our great-great-grandchildren. Jim Hoy is a well-regarded author and folklorist and professor with a doctorate in medieval and Renaissance English literature. If you should call him doctor, he will insist you call him Jim. He helped to popularize the phrase most folks in the Flint Hills use to describe the subtle beauty of the place. The Rocky Mountains take your breath away. The Flint Hills let you catch your breath. His son Josh runs the family ranch, which fattens cattle and slenderizes dudes. They run 250 head of longhorn and maybe 1,200 yearling cattle. Vacationers come here to ride and ranch a week or two at a time. Tallgrass legend has it that Zebulon Pike was sitting on their property when he made that Flint Hills Journal entry. Josh is married to Gwen, and they both wear the big straw hats favored here against the sun. And Josh, with his brush mustache and wire-rimmed glasses, bears an uncanny resemblance to young Teddy Roosevelt. "I'd like to be a cowboy," Josh says, "but I have too much debt and too many ulcers. I'm not really a cattleman. I'm a rancher. I care more about the grass. I love cattle. I love horses. And all that. But it's the land I'm most concerned about. We've put conservation easements on all the acres we can that we actually own and control, which isn't enough, but it's some. But yeah, the generational transfer in this generation and the next generation after that coming up is going to drastically change this landscape, because right now land is really starting to turn over in this area." I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleradingservice.org. Address any questions to us at 919-832-5138.